We should. I feel like we should retroactively put in a spoiler because we've spoiled the fucking movie, right? If you're a dog person, then you probably want to just watch the film. Right. Definitely. Well, so this is a retroactive announcement that you can put in.
Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important films and contemporary classics. My name is Chris and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Vittorio De Sica's 1952 film Umberto D. But before we do that, it's episode 201.
Oh my god.
Which means it's time for a look back at the last 10.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So...
Shit, can I look at the fucking list?
Yes, you can. I sprung that on you. Yeah. So we have Jubilee, Coup de Grâce, Key de Affairs, Il Posto, I Fidanzi, Hiroshima Mon Amour, Night and Fog, Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, Schizopolis, and The Honeymoon Killers.
Oh, yeah. It was a pretty good block.
Yeah,
films.
For the most part.
Except for Jubilee, that's my worst.
Yeah, we can just give that right away.
That was rubbish.
Yep. But in terms of best, it's kind of an interesting one because it's all over the map.
Yeah.
It's.
I'll do like some recommend. I mean, yeah. I think I would say Night and Fog to me was the best film.
Yeah.
I mean, it was certainly the most impactful. It's. Yeah, I guess like the subject matter that of
it's hard not to
of the
hit a chord.
Camps, it's like you're not going to be not affected.
Yes,
but at the same time, I think it was a remarkable documentary. So I would probably say that's the best one for me.
I put Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, or Hiroshima Mon Amour mm-hmm. right up there for me.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those films, I think, are great, wonderful, kind of similar, like, looks at, like, deconstructions of, like, relationships and things, and it's nice, interesting films.
Yeah, I agree with
but
you.
But even then, like, the two Olmi films were great as well, like, it's kind of had a plethora of great stuff here.
Your poster, yeah, fucking oath, it was a real good run.
Mm.
Except for Jubilee.
And, like, even Schizopolis is, like, a weird kind of meta breakdown on what is a film, to some degree,
yeah,
even. Like,
yeah. I liked it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I'll ever see it again.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's nice to have seen it, yeah. And Honeymoon Killers is worth it for that Scorsese sequence alone.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah. So, but, I, yeah, there's too many. But I think if I had to pick one, I would probably go Hiroshima Mon Amour for me. With a asterisk next to Night and Fog. Being like that's a very important film that people should see.
Fuck Earth. So...
it's only 40 minutes. It's a nice, short, little documentary piece. And,
so, yeah. Alain... is it René?
Alain René, yeah.
Okay. He wins.
Mm.
Fucking great filmmaker.
And Derek Jarman, you lose.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm gonna waste the time, Jubilees.
Yeah, you can avoid that one at all costs. But I guess we should jump into Umberto D. This week's film by Vittorio De Sica.
Yeah, Italian film.
1952. Old man and his dog.
Yeah, I mean, you just did the synopsis basically. That's about it. I mean, yeah. So let's do a synopsis to start.
Yeah.
You go.
So it's basically...
No, I'm okay.
It's basically an elderly gentleman and his dog struggling to survive off the meagre pension he gets from being a government worker for 30 years. That's essentially it.
That's it.
You know, it's a nice, short, sweet, hour, 28 minutes kind of film that is just kind of following... essentially, it's like almost like a week or so in the life of this man as he's trying to survive and goes through the trials and tribulations of being kicked out of his house, or, like, you know, being threatened to be kicked out of his house and then, you know, ultimately deciding to leave and just kind of relieve himself of that whole situation. You know, the friends he encounters along the way, like the maid in his building who's going through her own troubles at the same time. A couple of old people that he used to work with that he's trying to borrow some money off of unsuccessfully.
Well, they got their own problems with financially as well.
Yeah.
I think they're pensioners as well. Probably have their own story that's just as impactful.
Yeah, and so it is just essentially this man and his dog kind of wandering through trying to live life, I guess.
Trying to get by, but I thought what was really interesting is the way that the film decides to tackle... It's never really his fault. He's always just a product of this system that he's a part of. So, you know, he can no longer work. It seems to me that he's very able. He's just not allowed to anymore. He's getting kicked out of the landlord, needs to do her own thing. So he's getting kicked out of there. It's not his choice. It just seems like the system is just not really providing for him.
And that's kind of... Do you think that's an overall statement that the writer-director's making, being like, we don't acknowledge or kind of properly take care of the older people in our society, and this is kind of shining a light on that?
Well, yeah. But also, I mean, like, it's a similar case for the dogs when they go to the pound.
Oh, so you think it's a larger thing of just people in general? We don't take care of people.
Yeah, I mean, well, people got their own... Everybody in this film has their own problems, and there's compassionate people and there's not. If you look at, say, in the hospital, there's the doctors who are the authority figure. They're like the, you know, they're the head honchos of the medical system. And they seem to not give a shit. They're like, you're fine. I understand.
We need the bed.
You may be here because it's the only place you're going to get a feed, potentially.
Yeah.
But you got to get the fuck out.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the nurses are like, oh, I'll give you a few extra biscuits here. And I'll see what I can say.
They understand the larger picture of what's going on here. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's
provided,
just...
Provided... Sorry.
Well, no, that's Cole. Yes, go on, Cole.
Provided that you pray.
Yes.
And stick to your faith.
Well, that's okay.
That's okay. I mean, it's 1950s, early 50s Italy. Like, that's... it's conceivable that everyone's a Catholic there.
Cole's very rebellious
what
for
1950s. What I'm pointing out, though, is the system that Tom's talking about is not just government system, there's also... that religious system as well, is that look after you.
Oh, yeah.
If you behave properly in our religion. So if you didn't ask for the rosary, it's likely that she wouldn't have shown him as much care as she showed the other guy who did ask. So there is still part of, like, being in that system that is required.
The rosary being the necklace with the
prayer beads. Yeah.
The prayer beads, yeah. Okay.
So, sorry, I just wanted to sort of point out that wasn't... that nurse doing that out of the goodness of her heart. She was doing that out of her doctrine of religion.
And I didn't get this when Tom was saying, like, you know, the system stuff. I wasn't necessarily thinking that was just government and work system. I thought that he was meaning, like, a blanket of systems, I guess. Like,
but they are governmental systems. They are, like, the systems of like, the workforce at large.
But also, like, you know, the religious system, the societal system, it's just all...
It's all part of it.
He's trying to find his place as an elderly gentleman, like, when his life is shifting and changing for him, and he is trying to fit in, and it's just not... No one is kind of... There's no spot for him anymore.
That's right.
And it's that horrible thing of when you hit a certain age, and it's just like... All right, well, you're now a burden, I guess.
Yeah, whatever are we going to do with you?
And the filmmaking does an interesting point of, this guy is not feeble. Like, he shouldn't be considered a burden. He's just a nice old man who, granted, I guess he isn't bringing in as much money because there's, you know, the issues happening with the pension. And, like, the opening scene of the film is, you know, marches and, you know, things against the government for that. But he just seems like a nice old guy who's trying to make it work.
Oh, that's the supreme drama that comes from the movie.
Yeah,
now.
And
supreme, I'm sorry.
He is trying to make it work.
No, I'm not saying a man is trying to make it work.
Oh, he's a very positive person.
Is he?
Yeah.
I think he...
I mean, that's to a certain point.
You're just hung up on the last 20 minutes of the film.
I'm coming over here for this.
Yep.
No, I mentioned halfway through that I wasn't following the protagonist at all. I didn't care about him at all. I didn't think that he was accepting the situation with any kind of reality. He was kind of sulky. He didn't do anything to help his situation at all. He just wanted things to stay the way they were, even though the world around him was changing.
Yeah, that's... I agree with that.
He wasn't trying to get along in that world at all. He was trying to avoid a lot of things.
You're referring to the fact that he wants his old... room back, specifically that one.
He wants to be where he's always been, and he doesn't want things to change, which was kind of what I was trying to get to, I guess, with saying that, like, the world and every and society, everything's changing around him, and he doesn't see a place for himself in that. He still wants everything to be how it's always been, and as it is now changing and evolving around him, there is no spot for him, and he's now dealing with that.
Do you think he tries to find a spot? That he, like, there was never any moment in the film where you see him looking at other men in his situation. Well, actually, you do.
Yeah, at the very beginning when they're at the cafeteria and things.
Well, I missed the beginning. But at the end, he runs into a couple of blokes he knows in the city who are obviously his age. They're obviously his friends.
Mm. Oh, it's like, no, they're the people that are still working for the government. And he was...
They're still working.
Mm.
So he goes to them to ask for money to help just try and fix the situation he's in rather than trying to adapt.
Mm.
He doesn't go to them and go, could I still do that? No, I can't. There's never any, like, could I still do that? No, I can't still do that. There's never any question of why don't you go to work? Why don't you find somewhere cheaper to live? He just wants that room, despite warnings all through the film that it's going to change and there's nothing he can do about it.
Is it explicitly said that he's on a forced pension?
I think yeah, I feel like there's a line early on, like, because I'm under the assumption that he was, you know, ousted from his job, like, kind of forcibly pushed into retirement, which is why he's no longer working and forced to take the pension. Whereas, like, the people that he runs into on the bus and things, that's, like, his superior at work, whereas he was just a worker. I kind of want to counter you a little bit, because you're going hard against Umberto here, and I think he's a lovely gentleman. I put myself in that position of, like, you know, okay, I'll posit this to you, Cole. Like, if that you know, cut to, you know, 40 years in the future or whatever, and you just all, you're told...
If I was in the situation.
Yeah, if you were in the situation, you were told, nah, you can't work anymore, you've got to take this meager pension, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make ends meet, and you've been living in the same... you're just like, nah, just fucking grow up, move on, come on.
That's the
times are changing. Come on, hop to grandpa. Like, it's
not. If you were Umberto, you'd be like, you would be satisfied with somebody going, "What are you doing? You need to just fucking buck up and just change fundamentally." Even though you kind of just really want to just be quiet and be set in your own little ways.
I think I can understand, I guess, mm-hmm. but I inherently personally disagree with the whole. Listen, mate, the world around you is changing, and you kind of move. You need to move on. Instead of accepting that, he plants his feet like a stubborn old bastard. Does not accept.
Wow, you're coming so hard at
Umberto. I don't like him. I
feel
don't
you. Like you him. Got. You turned on him when he tried to get rid of his dog.
No. We'll get into that right. In a sec. No, yeah. It was before that. Remember, I mentioned to you guys. I'm like, I don't care anything for this protagonist.
Mm.
Like, so far, I only care about Flyke, and that was way before he actually left the apartment.
Okay, so you've got a problem with his motivation.
I've got a problem with the character. I don't see anything endearing or positive about his character. He is just a stubborn old bastard who just wants things his way.
I feel like he was prepared to continue working. I mean, he's just trying to...
I can totally see where you're coming from. How I viewed it, though, is I saw a man who was, against his will, found himself in a position, and things have quickly changed around him, and he's trying to deal with them, and it's everything all at once is happening.
How is he trying to deal with it?
Well, I mean, he's trying to raise the money to be able to stay in his place. Like, she's... And in like, yes, he owes money to the landlord. Like, that's fair. Despite the fact that he looked after her during the war and gave her half of his rations every week and did all this, and she was super nice during the war, and then that ended and she flipped and became a bitch. Movie's words, not mine. He at no point in the film does she explicitly say, "I want you to leave, I'm getting married and I want to turn your room into a dining room." She never says that. She just says, "You owe me money, rent is due." That's it. And then he eventually comes home and finds his room demolished and things. And...
Okay. We're getting into the bitch here. It's her house. and he, it's a
yeah okay it's but if you, but if you have a tenant, you have a right to tell that person if you are going to throw all this shit out and demolish their room.
She did, though. No, she didn't. There is a line. She says, in 30 days,
yeah,
I'm throwing your things out.
Then 3 days later, she gets the demolition guys to bash open his room and destroy
it. Yeah, while he's in hospital.
Yeah.
For, like, maybe 2 days.
2 days. The film, actually, it is explicitly he's in hospital for 2 days.
But we don't know how long in between, like, 2 days. From the beginning to- And I'm not saying how long he
but okay. before. The night he goes to hospital, she says, you have 30 days. And then 2 days later, she's just like, nap.
So, is that the night he goes to hospital?
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get any sense of time there.
It's that night. It's the same night after Maria, the maid, has told him that, you know, her predicament of being pregnant and the two men. The film takes place over about a week, I would say. And so she just escalates, and it's, I think she represents, like, the driving force of essentially society, I think, changing around him, and, like, the house and her represent, like, the changing times, and he is an old man kind of stuck in the way, he's dealing with it, and...
He needs to get out of the way, and that's why
he eventually, like, what? When he comes home to find his room completely demolished and things, and he's like, well...
But his stuff is still there.
His stuff, it's...
And yeah. She doesn't kick him out. She doesn't say you can't come in.
Well, dude, there's the law. There's newspaper on his bed and a hole in the wall. And yeah. Come on. They could have moved the newspaper off an old man's bed. There's your heart. but I think, like, that's the turning point in the film. Like, he comes home, like, using her as the kind of, and the house as the facsimile for society and, you know, at large. Coming home, finding himself out of place, having no place to properly fit in there, and that's where he just jumps to his escalates to a point of, well, if I have no place here, meaning, you know, the world and society, I just need to die now, and then shift into the...
And again, like, maybe symbolically within the film,
yeah.
Like, if we're talking about he doesn't have a place in... if. Not having a place in the house
mm-hmm.
is symbolic of not having a place in society.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, whatever. But in the logic of the film and the actual narrative, there was no attempt on his part to try and find any other way to make it work. It was like, well I don't have my room anymore.
Disagree. The film opens with him trying to sell his watch, and then he goes and sells his watch and a bunch of his books and his possessions. He's trying to make the money, yeah. And he offers her 3/4 of the money that he owes her as a down payment, and he'll get the rest.
Everything he does is to try and maintain something that is already slipping away.
But
so he sells his stuff to get the money to keep the room.
That's what he wants, though.
Yeah. He wants to stay in his room. He lived there his whole life. Yeah, like, why should he have to? Anymore. No, this is my, yeah, this is the argument, sorry. Because she never says, you have to go. She keeps him dangling there of, you can maintain this life, and then forcibly makes him not. That's the issue. At no point does she say, I want you out because I'm moving on with my life. She just keeps saying, you owe me money to stay. And that's it. At no point does she say, reasonably talk to him like a human being and say, I am moving on with my life, I'm getting married, I want my house back, which is what you're saying. Like, at no point does that conversation happen, so that's why he's just trying to fix the solution that is getting his bills and rent paid.
And
then finds him...
He doesn't recognise that... I mean, he's the one who says that she's the one that changed. She used to be friendly, now yeah. She's not. The place is not a happy place to live. The only person there he likes is... No, it's not...
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. But it was also the place he's lived for 30 right. years.
Right. And when he realises that the maid is right, he would probably be happier anywhere else. That's the night he decides, I'm going to kill myself.
And that's
the night he jumps up. Well.
Yeah. It's dark.
It is really dark. And I think it's the logical... It's like at his wit's end. It's like, you know what? There is fucking actually literally no place for me at all. I am going to kill myself. Brutal. Dramatic. But it is the start of something so wonderfully beautiful in the film that you... I mean, surely, like, there's this click in your brain where you're going like, oh my God, this guy's not going to kill himself for his dog.
Because essentially the film ends with him realizing there is a place for him in the world, and that is as the companion and caretaker of Flag.
Flag.
Took a long time to get to that, and every step along the way I wanted to smack that man. So you're saying, okay, you're like, oh, this beautiful little moment where you snap and go, he's not going to kill himself because of the dog.
Yeah.
And then the next scene, he's trying to get rid of the dog so he can kill himself. And well, then I'm just like, no, okay.
That's still part of the character.
Then the next scene, he tries to get rid of the dog so he can kill himself. He just keeps trying to find ways to abandon the dog who doesn't want to leave him.
He's not I would disagree with that. I think he's trying to find a suitable replacement home for the dog. He's not abandoning the dog.
Yes, he does. He goes to great lengths to make sure that
he does attempt to abandon him.
And then the dog finds him and he decides no.
It's all part of the character arc.
Yeah, it is. It's essentially the if there was no dog there, the dog essentially represents like his inner struggle and the idea of like having something tenable to hold him into this world. And that's why he's trying to run away from his responsibilities, he's trying to run away from everything, he tries to get rid of that with him, and it still doesn't work, and it's just him accepting this position and this like responsibility and what he has in life.
That's fair enough. But the entire film, the entire journey, I can't agree with this character.
Yeah, I realize like
agree with the character.
We're like kind of have been like going back and forth arguing it, and it's just one of those fundamental things of you didn't like the protagonist, and nothing we can say will convince otherwise. No, so.
I watched this character's story, and I thought, in a very broad, taking it to extremes, I think it was a piece of shit.
That is very extreme, though.
That is very extreme, and especially since...
nothing redeemable about him, except finally in the end, how much he, like, realises how much he loves flight.
Okay, and I think I'm going to speak for Tom here as well. Both of us thought he was a lovely old gentleman.
He really was lovely, and he was very old.
And you thought he was a horrible piece of shit.
I thought he was a piece of shit.
So we were, like, going so polar opposites. Isn't film wonderful, everybody?
Take Flake out of the equation.
Yeah.
What is redeemable and likable about his character?
Okay. I think
he doesn't want to accept charity. There's a sequence that's really lovely where he just can't bring himself. I love this shot. He's like thinking about taking some charity off like begging on the street, puts his hand out, and then a guy's about to put money in, and he just like turns his palm the other way around. So he's kind of like seeing if it's actually raining. Lovely. So, you know, he's got, I guess you could call it some kind of honor around him.
As well as he has a connection with Maria and wants to try and help her with her situation of not knowing who the father is and things. And, you know, like...
And he's pretty positive. Why are you such a naysayer?
Do or say to help her?
Well, I mean, I just jumped to him at the hospital, like, banging in the windows and things, like, trying to get the guy's attention and stuff.
Because of the dog. Because the man was holding Fly.
Yeah, true.
The only other time you see Maria talking to the soldier in the street, telling him she's pregnant, and he just walks off.
Mm.
And there is a small moment of indignation where he's like, you know, good day, sir, to the man.
But, okay, to counter that...
What does he say to Maria?
Where's
my dog? Not even after, where's my dog? Oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
How did that go? Okay. All he goes is like, if that dog's hurt, I'll kill it.
Wow. I don't understand. Like, you hate this man.
Yeah, I think it's...
This is bizarre.
It's like the only redeemable thing about him.
Okay, I want to shift slightly. with you, your total hatred for this protagonist, is that...
I had no idea we were going to be talking about hatred for this protagonist.
Because when it started this episode, just was like, we're going to talk about Grandpa and his lovely adventures in the city.
You guys are blinded by the fact that he's an old man. You see old man and go, oh, this old man wasn't very special. This old man was a bit selfish.
This is the point I want to get on. With your hatred of this protagonist, what do you feel the film is saying then essentially? Like, what is its... And essentially, did you like this film?
This is the thing. This is where I struggle to get beyond that. Because I didn't like the protagonist, I didn't feel engaged with the film. The only character I was engaged with was Flike.
Yeah.
And that was on a very narrative level, like a very surface level.
Flake doesn't have an arc.
He's a representation, essentially.
That's what I mean. I can't, unlike you guys, I can't get beyond that character into the symbolism. Like, talking about, okay, you know, if he doesn't have a place in this house, it, you know, it symbolises that he doesn't have a place in society. I can't get that far because I did not engage with the character, so I didn't engage with the film.
Yeah.
And I can't see beyond that.
Right.
I disconnected.
Okay.
That's, I just want to,
yeah,
check in on that.
I'll let you guys get into the symbolism of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I needed to interject. You got this lovely old man. I'm like, no.
Well, no, that's what's...
I can't sit and listen to this.
But that's what's absolutely wonderful about film. Like, we can all sit down
watch
the same film, but be watching totally different films.
Yeah.
Like, that's why it's great.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So he's a lovely man, isn't he, Tom?
He really is.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you guys. Carry on now.
Thanks, Cole. Yeah. I genuinely loved... I loved this character. I should clarify. Like, the first half hour was one of those films for me where I was like, "Where is this going? What are you doing? What are you saying? What are you all about?" And then once it starts to become apparent of what it is all leading towards, it becomes so engaging and so interesting. And for me, the turning point of kind of sitting there being like, all right, what are we watching now, to fully engaging with the film, is the sequence early in the morning where Maria makes coffee.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That's where it became a film for me. Like, yes. Really...
It was a slow moment, wasn't it?
Beautiful sequence.
The soundtrack, fucking incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't expect it, the first... How far into this? Like 30 minutes in?
Yeah, it's about 30. It's about like 29, 30 minutes
you
in,
know,
yeah.
It's you know, this happens and this happens. It's setting up the whole.
It's
know,
kind
this
of
this guy's, you know, stroke of bad luck, bad luck.
It's establishing
luck.
The base narrative stuff of, you know, who Umberto is. He's an old man. He has a pension, but meanwhile, they're protesting for an increase in pension. Like, so you've got all. It's establishing all the turmoils that surround this man and the people that are around him, like Maria and, you know, the landlady and things. Mm. And this is the first moment in the film where you get just a little bit of a break from that.
Yeah. The film, it's like the film stops working and starts being just like a nice, proper
a film.
Artistic expression.
It's like, all right, we're done with all of our setup and our narrative. Yeah. Let's just fucking be for a second. Yeah, and it's wonderful.
That's right. And at that point, I was like, oh, man, I think we've got something special here.
Yeah. And it's that, it's just instantly in a moment, there's absolutely no dialogue. It's just visual storytelling. Like, his choice of camera angles and when to push in particular. This film has some amazing moments where the camera just decides to, like, subtly move in on its characters. Like, it's beautiful.
It kind of reminded me of Punch Drunk Love, you know?
Okay,
it's
yeah.
The same kind of movements where it's... And even the soundtrack as well. It's like this nice, calm, bubbly thing.
Mm-hmm.
And these characters just kind of being quiet, moving around. The camera's doing its nice little, beautiful, elegant work and whatever. Yeah, that scene was the kicker offerer.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean...
And then from there, we end up that kind of... I don't think... There's maybe like one or two sequences post that. It kind of gets a bit of a lull again when he's panhandling, I feel. Despite having wonderful moments, like you said, of him rejecting begging and things and getting Flyke the dog to beg for him for a little bit and things. Like, there's some little flourishes, but it's almost like we're presented a day of him just kind of meandering, which is a lull. But then beyond that, once the ultimate decision, he decides what he's going to do is... kill himself, and that's when the film, again, just... It's little moments. It's just little sequences.
That moment where he decides to kill himself, and I think it's like half an hour before the end.
Mm.
That last 30 minutes is, like, fucking so dramatic.
Yeah.
Just incredible that you can have a relationship between a man and a dog and have that much drama squeezed out of that scenario. It's just fucking outstanding.
Of just a man, like... And it's also, like, him deciding to kill himself is only presented through visual language. He doesn't say, I'm going to kill myself. You don't see him writing a suicide note. You don't see him... I mean, there is that brief moment where he tells Maria, like, you can have the things that I've left. But you could infer that, I guess, to he's just moving out and can't be bothered. Well,
I didn't pick up on that he was going to kill himself.
But it's like the visual language of him. Like, Da Silva does, like, this... Da Silva does this amazing thing where he just telegraphs to the audience in this beautiful visual way of his mind being made up, that he needs to kill himself, and then it's looking over and realizing he has the dog, and he needs to deal with this final responsibility in his life before he can move on, and then that's the last half hour of the film. I could legit have watched, like, an hour 20 of just him... Like, if there was, like, 10 minutes of setup of this man being kicked out of his house, he has no job, he has no money, and he just decided to kill himself, is an hour 20-minute film of him trying to...
deal with the last responsibility.
Yeah. Like, that's essentially what the film is to me, but it's the last half hour, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, that's so right. Like, yeah, that could be a fucking full film, just that, that massive dramatic shit that's going on there.
Yeah.
And
you can have the full act, like, you know, the full character arc of the realization of what life means and why it's important and, like, why he should not, like, kill himself. There's all, you could have that. We essentially have the full arc in the last half hour of the film.
Yeah.
Which I think, could have been one of the reasons why Cole didn't necessarily connect with him as a character, but is because for, you know, 60 minutes of, you know, an hour and a half long film, there is no progression, there is no arc of him as a character, and it is that last half hour where you actually see it all change for him.
It also doesn't help that I'm incredibly a dog person.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Cole is, like, so much of a fucking dog person, not even funny.
I cried at the end of that because I thought he was going to kill Fly.
So did Flyke.
That moment where he thinks he's about killing himself in the room... and then turns to Flyke and goes, oh, no.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, thank God. He's actually... here's his arc starting. He's finally realised that his place in the world is with Flyke. And it takes him... But he's like, oh, no, I can't kill myself until I find somebody to take you on because you're a burden.
That's, like, the beginning of his arc.
And also, like, I disagree with what... Like, you... You added the word burden there at the end. That's, like, I'm coming hard at you. I apologize. But, like, that's, like, that's you applying that to him. I don't, like,
everybody else, everywhere he takes him, the people that he tries to see, you know, can you take Flyke? Flyke is a burden to them.
But they're not, he's not a burden to him.
Exactly, but he doesn't.
But no, but that's, like... I don't think he views him as a burden.
No, he doesn't. But everywhere he... Like, he is a burden that he's trying to get rid of, and he's the only one who actually loves Flyke.
No, but, like, where I picked up on was your...
But Flyke is in the same situation as he is in. No one wants Flyke. They want to just go, go away. I mean, you know, you're going to be okay, of course, but just go away. Just like everybody is going, Umberto, go away. Are you going to be okay, of course, but just go away. So there is a bit of a mirror going on.
And where I kind of... Like, what kind of sparked that for me was, like, you were saying, like, he decides he wants to kill himself, but then he looks over... You said he looks over and sees the dog and is like, oh, I have this burden. That's in...
No,
that's what you said. That's why I've jumped. I'm sorry. And that's why I came hard. But
I call him a burden because when he tries to start getting rid of him, he's... a burden.
Yeah.
He becomes a burden then. The look on his face when he turns to Flyke is not, oh, you're my burden, but he sees him as the one last job that he needs to take care of before he can go and do the selfish thing of fucking off. Instead of
I don't think it's a job for him. I think it's him knowing that Flyke is safe and happy and will have a good life. I don't think that's a job. That's just...
But when he realises he can't find that for Flyke, he devolves into... very, very cold decisions.
Yeah. And then realizes very quickly that that was a horrible mistake, and that's where we have our giant finale wonderfulness.
This is the thing.
Only because of Flyke. Flyke A didn't come back to him after he ditched him, right, he would have ditched him.
That would have been the most horrible, dark, sad ending of the film ever.
If Flyke didn't freak out at the train, he would have thrown him in front of the train. This man's decisions...
No, he didn't step into the line of the train. He wasn't going to get hit. He didn't make the final call. He couldn't do it.
You don't know that because Flyke freaked out and it distracted him.
Okay. fine.
I think without
but
Flyke's reaction, Flyke saved himself in both of those situations. That man would have gone through, as far as I can see from the film, would have gone through with those decisions he just made. And that is not okay with me.
Okay. But he has been driven. I think the film has tried and succeeded in setting up that he is desperate. He is desperate. He is, in terms of trying to get cash, he is fucking desperate. In terms of trying to deal with the final responsibility of his dog Flyke, he is desperate. So there's this constant growth of the character, him trying to figure out how best to deal with the situation. He does make bad calls, but it's because he's in a desperate situation. And the film does, it's all there. He's struggling the whole time.
I think maybe it's because, like I said, I'm a dog person. Imagine if...
So is Umberto.
So am I as well. Like, I'm a hardcore dog person. But I'm, like, I am able to, like...
If this was a child, would it be acceptable for him to just leave them in a park?
But he...
Walk away and then hide from them.
No, but I know that you think dogs are children.
When he left Flyke in the park, he did not go back for Flyke.
Mm.
He hid from Flyke and Flyke found him.
Yeah.
The only reason he picked him up and carried on was not... He did not have that moment of going, oh, this is a terrible decision, I can't do this.
Mm.
He would have left him there.
Yeah.
Bad person.
Oh, yeah.
Don't care desperate you are. That person, because,
Flyke found him. So the next point is, he's like, I'm fucking desperate. I'm picking him up and we're both getting killed by a train. Desperation. He regretted it immediately. And then we're treated to just the most beautiful 2 minutes in film history. Particularly.
I think after that, when Flyke ran away from him after that,
yeah.
Flyke should have fucking kept going.
Well, I am dead serious. I think that last 2 minutes is like on par with Life is Beautiful bittersweetness. That whole film, like, I'm going to compare this film to Life's Beautiful. I don't think it's as good, but I still think that there is a bittersweetness there that is just remarkably beautiful. I love this movie. I love Umberto.
I
love Flyke.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Cole is just a very, very passionate dog lover, and... That is 100% okay.
To be fair, like I said, it was earlier, much earlier on in the film, I said, I'm not caring. I'm not finding myself caring about
that. Yeah. And I knew, like, yeah. So.
Yeah. And he didn't win any awards later on.
But he was playing with Flyke with the pinecone at the end, which I thought was just lovely.
And he had his wonderful realization of that life is worth it. I mean, for God's sake, look at the cover of the Blu-ray. He's hugging
that.
The dog.
It's so pretty. Look at
it,
that.
It sums it up perfectly.
Oh, what a wonderful man and dog and movie.
Yeah. No, that's what's great, though, about movies is everyone can have total different opinions and perspectives.
And experiences,
so. Yeah. It's wonderful. But yeah, I also adored this film and thought it was wonderful, and the arc that is... Like I said, like it's just that last 30 minutes, essentially, of him making his decision about where he's going to end up and then trying to pragmatically deal with that as best he can, and then having his shift and his change makes this film so wonderful.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Sorry.
No, continue that thought.
Oh, I was just going to say, not to mention the wonderful use of music, lighting, cinematography, everything about it is superb.
Fucking earth. We should...
First 20 minutes where you're kind of like, what is this? What am I watching?
It's okay.
Yeah.
I feel like we should retroactively put in a spoiler, because we've spoiled the fucking movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I think, and we never once said prior to us talking about the film, that... If you're a dog person, then you probably want to just watch the film. All definitely.
Right. Well,
so this is a retroactive announcement that you can put in
yep.
afterwards to watch the film if you're a dog person. Unless you're Cole's level of dog person, then you may dislike it, depending on your sensibilities. Anyway, I recommend the movie.
Yep. I as well thoroughly enjoyed this film. I thought this was wonderful and big, big, big thumbs up for me.
Mm.
Do you want to hear a little bit of trivia about it?
Sure.
So the film was nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 1952 Cannes Film Festival, as well as the Academy Award for Best Screenplay at the 1957 Oscars. And the film is included in Roger Ebert's Great Movies list.
How big is that list?
I don't know. It's fairly, I think, a couple hundred.
You just pulled that number out of here.
Oh, yeah, totally. I had no idea. I'm just guessing.
It's probably a big list.
It's probably big.
Anyway, the point is that it's on his list.
Yeah, and, you know, he's a great film critic and thought it was great.
Fucking Martin Scorsese, you mentioned.
Yeah, I saw this on Twitter, I think, the other day, that someone was circulating. Martin Scorsese has a list of, like, what he considers to be the 39 essential world movies.
It's an odd number to fill out.
Yeah, 39. I think it's just him just being like, oh, these are movies I think that are essential. Oh, it ended up being 39 of them. And this, as well as, obviously, Vittorio De Sica's previous film, The Bicycle Thieves, which we'll eventually get to in the spine numbers, mm-hmm. Were both on the list, so, yeah.
Fucking nice. Mm. So, well-regarded movie.
Yeah. This film is the first and only for non-actor Carlo... font is way too small. And I don't have my glasses on. This is the first and only film for non-actor Carlo Battisti, who played the leading role in the film. His real occupation was that of professor of linguistics at the University of, somewhere.
A university?
Yeah. Universita...
Oh no, my beer. What? University degli studi di Firenze?
That's the one.
I fucking know.
Yeah. non-actor Maria Pia Casilio, who plays the role of the housemaid Maria in the film, got the part when she accompanied a friend to see the real actress to see the real actresses competing for the film's audition. Director Vittorio De Sica spotted her in a balcony and knew she was exactly what he was looking for the role. Maria went on to work with De Sica in three other films and continued to work in films until the late 1990s.
So he picked her on the look then?
Yep.
I guess, which is fair enough. I mean, the eyes especially.
Oh, yeah.
Just her eyes are fucking... There's a lot of shit going on there. A lot of emotion, a lot of loveliness.
It's really similar to, obviously, Roma that's out at the moment, the Alfonso Cuarón film. Like, he just saw her and picked her, and she was a university graduate who was just like, man, I just finished uni and I'm going off to, like, start my career, but I guess I'll do this if you want me to. Why not? And now is in the film that's probably going to win Best Picture. there were two dogs used in the film. The trained one has a black head and its right side is white. Another dog with a white muzzle and a black spot on its right flank is used in two scenes. Firstly, when Umberto is hiding from the police after demonstrating, and secondly, when he reclaims Flike from the pound. So, there were multiple flikes.
Did you pick up on that?
Nope, not at all. Wonderfully kind of hidden in the way that he shot it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last little bit of trivial trivia that I've got.
Mm-hmm.
Ingmar Bergman cited Umberto D as his favourite film.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Which kind of makes sense, the idea that, you know, most of Bergman's films are the realisation of man with his impending doom and... the existence of God and finding a place within the world, and so.
Well, it's nice to know that Bergman's got a soft spot.
To be like,
happy endings as well.
These are my themes, but it's presented in like a nicer way.
My themes with a twist.
Yeah, family friendly version of my themes. But unless you got anything else, so move on to the Criterion edition. It's still in print from Criterion as a one disc Blu-ray and a one disc DVD. And it comes with the special features of That's Life, Vittoria De Sica, a 55-minute documentary about the director's career, made for Italian television in 2001. Writings on Umberto D by Umberto Eco, Luisa Alessandri, and Carlo Battisti. That's only available on the DVD, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Interview with actress Maria Pia Casilio from 2003, as well as the usual... Sorry?
She the maid?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. As well as the usual booklet and essays that Criterion usually do.
Would you buy this one?
I'd be tempted, but it's one of those things of how often will I go back and re-watch it?
Yeah, well, you're a collector, though.
I know, I'm a collector, but it's... I'm like to be judicious in my collecting of, like, will I... This is a very wonderful film, and I really enjoyed it, but... Am I going to be sitting at home and crack open a beer on a Friday night and be like, I'm going to watch Umberto D?
Yeah, okay, like, maybe not.
I'm sure I will see this film again at some point, again in my life, but I, you know, do I need... They're so expensive to get them here in Australia.
That's true.
But yeah, unless you got anything else for this one?
No, I think I'm done.
That can wrap us up, and we'll be back in a fortnight's time with another Vittorio De Sica film.
Why are we doing a double?
Yeah, I know. I didn't realise that was next. We could have done a double. But that being said, we've run 45 minutes now on Umberto D alone. So.
Okay. I'm sorry,
I'm so close. No, it's fine. Okay. No, it's great.
It's good to have a dissenting opinion.
It's good to actually discuss and debate film. So it's usually awesome.
Usually Chris and I are like, I agree.
Yeah, and we would have had 25 minutes of a film.
It's been a while. I've forgotten how to speak civilly.
No, it's fine. It's great. But yeah, we'll be back with another De Sica film, Indiscretion of an American Wife, okay. From 1953, so we really should have done this as a double.
Yeah, this is supposed to be a double. Yeah. Oh well.
But yeah, I guess tune in a fortnight's time for what will be part two of our double. But other than that, you can send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter @CriterionQuest, or give a listen to my other podcast, You Haven't Seen That, where Tom's occasionally guested, Cole has guested, where we show our friend Eric films that he missed growing up.
Yay.
I think our last episode was Twister. He never saw that movie. And it's pretty interesting. Awesome. Interesting, I'll say.
Lol.
Yeah. But again, thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back in a fortnight with Indiscretions of an American Wife.
Oh, you say like that.
That's like the Alec Baldwin voice. I'm just traveling. No, that's not Alec Baldwin. That's modern-day Harrison Ford. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.